Well, good morning, Council Tree. My name is Jesse French. It's great to be with you guys, even if it's virtually this morning. So I'm pretty sure that there is not a less teachable person in the whole world than a 15-year-old teenager who just got their learner's permit to drive a car. I know this because I was 15 once, and as a 15-year-old, I was convinced of two things. Number one, that I already was a safe and excellent driver. And number two, that my parents' advice when it came to driving should be taken merely as a recommendation. So with this in mind, one summer evening, I was driving with my dad going east on Mulberry. We were right on the south side of City Park, if you can picture it. And I needed to turn left onto Jackson Avenue. And so, being the great and safe driver that I was, I put on my blinker, checked my blind spot, and casually began to turn into the left-hand turn lane. And suddenly, my calm father suddenly sprung into life and yelled, "Jesse, what are you doing?" He actually used more colorful language than that, but I looked at him as if it wasn't obvious, and I said, "Turning left?" And he said, "You're in oncoming traffic!" And it was at this point that I realized that that portion of Mulberry does not have a left-hand turn lane. And indeed, I had crossed over the double yellow, and we were sitting in oncoming traffic. I listened to my father, and I quickly darted out of the lane onto Jackson Avenue for fear of dying from a head-on collision or my father's boiling anger. In that moment, he had to disrupt my ignorance with volume, with choice vocabulary, so that I might learn. Friends, if we are to learn, we must have the humility to hear the disruption from other people. Well, this summer, we as a church are examining what it means to be a nation of priests. And Exodus 19:5 is a reference in Scripture that we've talked about. And in that passage, God is speaking to the Israelites at Mount Sinai, and God says, "Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Well, what does it really look like to be a priest? That word priest may conjure up some ideas of people with funny garb, with a funny hat. But ultimately, the role of the priest is a simple one. Priests are ones who are able to identify the work in the presence of God. Priests are the people who are able to look at their own lives, look at the lives within a body, and say, "This is the way that God is at work. This is his presence." Priests are the people that show the world what God is like. When God is standing at Mount Sinai and he says, "You're going to be a nation of priests," he is saying that because he needs the Israelites to show the rest of the world what it is like, what he is like. He's saying, "I need you to be representatives of my character. I need you to be ambassadors on my behalf." And so if that's what we as priests are supposed to do, one way that we can do that is by keeping and holding story. See, priests are the storytellers within the community. They have a sense of what has our collective story been, what has our individual story been. And more than that, more than just remembering story, they are also the interpreters of story. They're able to look back through a story and say, "This is the work of God. This is how he is present." And because of that, priests are able to embody faith. One of the ways that we see the priestly role come out is through this short and interesting phrase that is repeated throughout the Old Testament. Many times it is God that is saying it, but also Moses references it. And it's talking about and urging the Israelites to remember the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Moses says that a few times. God even says, "Remember me, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt." And this is a fascinating priestly sentence because in that sentence, it embodies the priest. It's calling the people to remember who God is. It's identifying God's work in their story as a God who brought them out of bondage. And it's showing other people who God is. Because in that sentence, we hear and see God as a God who hears the cry of the oppressed, hears the cry of the Israelites who are in bondage, and he acts on their behalf and helps them out of Egypt. So we learn and see God as a God who hears the cry of the oppressed. So in that statement, it is a priestly one. Remember the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. It is remembering God's presence, and it is showing the world God is one who hears the cry of the oppressed. I've been lucky enough to go and attend Council Tree since I was one, so that's 32 years. And with a rich sense of gratitude and a full heart, I can say when I consider all of you, this body is one of priests. You are a community of people who are able to identify the work of God in your own life. You're deeply faithful people, and you have shown me the character of God, and I am deeply grateful for that. Rob Bell says that when God invites the Israelites to be priests at Mount Sinai, it's an invitation to show the world who God is and what he is like. This is the rallying cause of priests, to show the world what God is like. And that is the same for us if we are to be a nation of priests. Well, if we continue to track the story of the Israelites, God gives them this directive to be priests, and the story gets off track. We continue to follow it within the Old Testament, and the Israelites totally botch this. We see them beginning to worship other gods, other idols from neighboring nations. We see them unfaithful to God. We see their leader, Solomon, in this bizarre story in 1 Kings 10. Solomon, who's the king of Israel, becomes an arms dealer, and he's importing and exporting chariots and horses. He's profiting from war. And so we see Israel lose sight of what their goal and what their cause is to be, to show the world what God is like. They get off track. And so in light of that, God acts by introducing this unique and needed character called the prophet. And if the priest is someone who is one who embodies faith, the prophet is one who embodies hope. Prophets are people who have a clear sense of the coming kingdom of God. And because of that future vision of this kingdom, they are then able to discern truth. They are then able to look at a people's course and say, yeah, we're on target to reach that vision, or we have gone astray and need a course correction. Because of that, and because of their ability to see that clearly, prophets offer words of truth and correction. And they do so honestly, often bluntly, often in grand metaphor and rich imagery. Prophets are not people who mince words. They don't sugarcoat things. They simply call things as they are. And their words are motivated not out of selfish ambition, not to be a jerk, but simply to call people to remember what we are designed to do. In this case, in the Old Testament, we see the prophets ultimately calling the people of Israel back to repentance and back into their role as priests. They're trying to say, hey, remember what God asked of us. We are to be God's representatives to show the world what God is like, and we are off course. In Amos chapter 3, Amos was an Old Testament prophet. And in chapter 3, he says these words. He says, hear this word, people of Israel. The word of the Lord has spoken against you, against the whole family I brought up out of Egypt. See the great unrest within her and the oppression among her people. They do not know how to do right, declares the Lord. Amos is acting as a prophet. He's offering these true, unminced, unsugar-coated words to the people of Israel. He's saying, remember, we are supposed to be priests. We are supposed to be representatives of God, and yet there's oppression among you. You do not know how to do what is right. There is zero fluff and sugarcoating in Amos's words. That is the role of the prophet, the one who speaks truth to power, the one who names our own idols. I came across this quote a couple weeks ago from Austin Channing Brown, and it's quickly becoming one of my favorites. And while she doesn't reference the actual role of the prophet, this sentence absolutely summarizes who the prophet is. She says this, I believe firmly that to practice love is to disrupt the status quo, which is masquerading as peace. To practice love is to disrupt the status quo, which is masquerading as peace. That is who the prophet is. The prophet looks and says, hey, this peace that you think you have, that may be the absence of conflict, is not the universal flourishing that God has intended for us. And so because of that, I'm willing to disrupt that with true words of naming how we have gotten off course and how we must course correct. If we are supposed to be priests who live out our calling to show the world what God is like, we must be willing to be humble, to hear the honest words of disruption and correction from the prophets around us. A few years ago, I was getting ready to start a new job at a ministry called Restoration Project. And some of that job required me to go and raise my own support. And so I invited my uncle one evening to come over to our house to hear about the work that I was getting ready to start. So my uncle comes over and we sit down in our living room, and I'm just about ready to launch into my spiel about the work that we're doing and why it's important. And he beats me to the punch and he says, "This is going to be real short. Your aunt and I are extremely excited about the work that you and the ministry is doing. But there's something I have to tell you. A few months ago, you and I were in a conversation via text and via voicemail. And in the middle of that conversation, you completely fell off the face of the earth. You ignored my response. You ignored my question. And in doing so, was deeply hurtful to me. And that type of communication cannot happen in your new job. If you're going to succeed in the work that you're doing, you must be better than that. Your communication must be clear. It must be consistent with other people. That has to get better if you're going to flourish in your job. Now, your aunt and I are extremely excited about what's ahead." And he stood up, gave me a hug, and walked out the door. And when he left, I sat back down on the couch, completely shell-shocked at what had just happened. I was expecting for me to give the elevator's pitch about, you know, why this is valuable, how he could come alongside and support. And instead, he blindsides me with a brief but incredibly honest and clear naming of how I had messed up and how I must change. And so this is an interesting interaction because of a few things. Number one, my uncle absolutely is the prophet in that story. He offers incredibly clear words of correction. This must change. If you're going to go into this work, you must be better. You have to course correct. But it's also interesting because when you look at his motive, why is he saying that? He's not just being the cranky and nitpicky uncle, but he's saying, I am excited about the work that you're doing, about you. I believe in that, and that's why I'm sharing this with you. That's not just to be critical of you. And so he absolutely is the prophet there who has deep care for his people, who names how they must course correct for them to be able to move forward. Well, what's also interesting is my reaction to his prophetic words. I sat down on the couch and began to replay the conversation that he had referenced, where my communication was poor, was hurtful to him. And what was my first reaction? That was not that big a deal. Like, the issue that we were talking about, I almost forgot. Like, it was so insignificant in my mind. And so, as I thought about that, I became defensive. That's a random deal. That's not going to carry over into my own job. This is a totally separate issue. And so I began to become defensive. I rationalized my own behavior and ultimately was bracing against the disruptive words that he was offering me. I did not want to see it. I did not want to hear them. Because isn't this what we do when we receive words of correction? We rationalize, we become defensive, we dismiss the other person. Anything to sit under the weight of those difficult words. Because disruption is never easy to bear. Because by definition, it is disrupting and churning up the paradigms that we hold, the ways that we view ourselves, the ways that we view the world. Disruption is starting to unravel that. And it is hard work to sit under those words and to actually consider them. We would rather rationalize. We'd rather be defensive. We'd rather dismiss that. But we as priests, if we are to show the world what God is like, actually have to choose a different way to respond to that disruption. I had a great professor at CBC named Todd Slekta, and he said this. He said, a disciple is someone who says, teach me. They're willing to learn not just from their rabbi, but from those around them. They are willing to receive anything and consider whether it is true. Doesn't that also need to be true of us as priests? That we would have the humility to receive disruptive words and hold them and not dismiss them, not rationalize our behavior, but be willing to consider them and be willing to receive them. I'll end with two stories about prophets. One happened a year ago, and it was a great summer dinner that I got to spend with my coworkers and a man named Dan Allender. And Dan Allender is this giant, well-known, incredibly well-respected man in the fields of Christian counseling, in the fields of trauma, in the fields of abuse. And he is just this wealth of information. And so my boss and friend Chris knows him, and Allender was going to be in town. And so he said, hey, can we have a dinner together? So I went, largely to be kind of a groupie and, you know, name drop later like I am right now, that I had dinner with Dan Allender. And so the dinner was great. And towards the end, one of my coworkers asked Dan to speak about the work of racial reconciliation that the school that Dan works at is undergoing and how they have engaged that issue over the past few years. And he did, and he began to speak about that. He began to speak a little bit about his own journey. He told the story of as he and his wife were engaging this issue of race and white privilege, how they pulled out the deed to their home and looked at the bottom of it, and at the bottom it said, this house may not be sold to a person of color. It was written in the 60s. And so Dan began to talk about the need for lament. He used the word white fragility. I'd never heard that before. He began talking about white supremacy. And he used that word in a much broader context than simply those who would light crosses on fire. He talked about white supremacy as an ideology that we participate in unknowingly. And so he talked about this. And as I was driving home that night, I thought about the dinner. And I thought, man, that was a good dinner. That whole white supremacy issue, isn't that a little harsh? Like, I'm not a white supremacist. I love everyone. I don't burn crosses on my yard. And it was in that moment that I was bracing against the prophetic words that he was offering. Because as he was speaking that night at dinner, he was offering disruptive words of the prophet. He absolutely was calling us to think about racism differently, to think about our participation within racism differently. He was disrupting the paradigms that I had held, and I braced against it. But ultimately, that did spark a consideration over the past year, a very slow one that I have had of what does it mean to engage racism and the disease of racism in honest ways. As much as I braced against that, his prophetic words have sparked a slow but very needed engagement of that within my own life. Well, 2 weeks ago, I heard words from another prophet. And this prophet is not famous. Her name is Daisha. She's a 25-year-old African-American woman who is delightful. I met her when we went and had dinner at a friend's house. And our friends were watching Daisha's son, and his name is Avon. He's 8 months old. And our friend said, hey, Daisha might come over and eat dinner with us. And we said, great. And so she did. She came and she ate dinner, and we had a wonderful evening. And towards the end of our time together, we began to speak about race. And she began to speak about her experience of racism. She told stories of racism here experienced within the last 2 years here in Fort Collins that were horrifying. And then she paused and she looked over at her son, who my wife Ashley was holding in her lap. And she said, Everyone loves my son right now as a baby boy. But I want them to love him the same way when he's a grown man. And those words continue to linger with me, because those prophetic words that she offers are absolutely the lament of where our country is now, that there is a gap in how her son will be treated from a baby to an 18-year-old man of color. And so it's lamenting that, and it is also deeply hopeful that she says, I hope that we as a country can take the needed steps so that there is not a gap between how my son Avon is treated now as a baby and when he is grown. Her words were disruptive, they were hopeful, and they were needed. Friends, if we are going to be priests who show the world what God is like, we must have the humility to hear the honest words of correction and disruption from the prophets around us.